Good morning. A few disclaimers. I feel like I always have to start with some disclaimers. So first of all, an unexpected scheduling conflict came up, so I'm going to have to end a few minutes early. And when I do, I'm going to run out, so I apologize. Don't mean to be rude, but I got into a little bit of a scheduling conflict. And also, it's crucial to point out that there will be no endorsements, that this topic of perspectives on presidential elections, so I insisted that it have an S at the end. This is not a perspective on this presidential election. And while we welcome our own president, it's not about the YU presidency. It is about the U.S. presidency, but it is not about the 2016 election in specific. Not explicitly or implicitly, not with a wink, not in any other sense of the word. We're not going to be making any statements which are meant to be directed at either candidate, but rather just to look at the general question of what's our relationship to participating in a presidential election in America, how do we relate to the whole subject, and what kind of factors are a part of the process as we try to decide who to vote for in any presidential election at any time, certainly on the national level. So the third disclaimer is, even without any specific candidates, don't expect any absolute answers to any of these questions, because they're not topics that lend themselves to absolute answers, but they are factors that hopefully are meaningful and relevant to us as we think about some of these topics and as we make these very weighty decisions. So just to begin with, the question of the relationship to democracy and the idea of voting. So democracy is not something which on the surface we associate with the Torah's vision. When we talk about the messianic vision of a Jewish state, we don't automatically see democracy as a part of it. We have an image of a monarchy. We talk about the Melech HaMashiach. We have a history of a monarchy. We don't necessarily see voting as a part of the process. The truth is, it is more complex than that. Even the role of the monarchy is subject to a lot of discussion, a lot of machlokis in the Meforshim, whether the idea of Som Tasim Alecha Melech, the idea that you should appoint a king, is that actually an imperative? Or is that a permission? Or is it perhaps even less than that? Maybe it's a bidyeved, maybe it's not really ideal at all, and that maybe if we were able to function without a king, maybe we'd be better off. But maybe there's a concept of a king because perhaps it's necessary. So all of these views you find in the Rishonim, you find the Netziv commenting on that pasuk, that it depends greatly on the kind of society that we have. Some societies need a king, some societies can't function at all with a king. And of course, to be standing here in America, a country that was founded as a reaction to a monarchy and that felt very much they needed a different model, although even that wasn't so clear at the beginning. They offered George Washington the monarchy. So it wasn't so obvious that that was the path it was going to take. But ultimately, that became very much a part of our national consciousness, that we are not a monarchy culture in America, so that we find really addressed already in the Rishonim, that some cultures work with a king, some cultures don't work with a king, and there are different models, and we have to figure out exactly what's appropriate for every setting. So that being said, there does seem to be a major role for the voice of the people in selecting the ruler. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos and Daftan Hey and Aleph, and I apologize that not everything made it onto the sheet, that's my fault, but there is a Gemara which tells us that Ein Mamidin Parnes Alatzibur, you cannot appoint a leader over the congregation, Ela Im Kein Nimlochim Batzibur Tchila, that you have to first get the counsel, get the advice of the people. And it's a big discussion how that plays out La Halacha. It doesn't necessarily come up in the monarchy context for us because we're not dealing with kings in our normal communal settings, but we have many other contexts in which this comes up. We talk about appointing communal leaders. We talk about appointing rabbis. The whole discussion of whether rabbis are in this category or not seems to be actually a debate among the Rishonim, and I'm sorry we won't have time to go through every detail of that question. Maybe I'm relieved we won't be able to go into every detail of that question. But there's a lot of discussion about whether a rabbi is in this category or not. Does he need the full authority and consent of the people? But it goes back to how you relate to the statement in the Gemara. And the Gemara actually talks about Bezalel, that God says, Moshe, how do you feel about Bezalel? And Moshe says, how do I feel? You're God, so you tell me how I feel. Do I want Bezalel or not? So God says, no, it's important that if we're going to appoint somebody, it has to be with the consent of the people. How do you feel about Bezalel? Well, then I guess we're all okay with Bezalel. So you have this process where, yes, it's coming from God, but there is a requirement for the consent of the governed. And it could be that that's also what we're talking about with the monarchy, that even to the extent that the monarchy is completely removed from any type of a voting process, but still it needs to be with the consent of the people. We have a notion of Ein Melech Bloam, and how exactly that plays out is also an extensive discussion. And it seems to be, as some explain, maybe a technicality, that yes, we do need people to vote, but when you talk about the leadership of the Jewish nation, so you want God's vote also, and who's going to vote against God? So essentially, more or less, it boils down to the consent of the people, but there's a reason why the monarchy is different. But when we deal with other contexts, perhaps that's going to indeed revert to what we relate to as a democratic process. And we think about the fact that Churchill famously commented that democracy is the worst form of government, with the exception of every other type that's been tried so far. And so his point apparently is that really from an efficiency perspective, democracy is not so ideal. If you want to get good decisions, if you want to have wise policy, so you go to the experts. You don't give this over to the vote of every individual of whatever degree of education and preparedness they may have. But at the same time, it's better than every other type that's been tried so far, presumably because the fear was persecution of the individual and abuse of the individual by the majority, what we call the tyranny of the majority. So democracy, which we often associate purely with voting, the truth is it's not just about voting. It's really about respect for the individual. It's about protecting the minorities and protecting the individual. So we do that on the one hand through one person, one vote, which is a way of giving every person a voice. But at the same time, the result could backfire. You could have the tyranny of the majority. You could have a majority voting to do whatever to the minority. And that's clearly not within democratic values. So when we talk about democracy, at least in the sense of anything that we're proud of, so presumably we really come from the respect for the individual. And that manifests itself through voting. So it's possible to say that within an ideal messianic era, within a perfected Torah system, we don't need voting to choose the monarch because God can tell us who is the monarch, who is the proper leader for the Jewish people. But in every other setting, whether it's American society or even Jewish society addressed in a more mundane level, perhaps in the exile or perhaps even in the land of Israel, so then perhaps we indeed do revert, even from a pure Torah perspective, to a voting model. And it's an interesting question as to what exactly we're trying to accomplish with the voting model. So when it comes to the idea of, let's say, the Zion Tuvei Ha'ir, we know that historically there was a model of administration that we had in Jewish communities of seven appointed executives. So the question of how those executives got chosen. So the Maharam Rutenberg is quoted by the Hagos Maimini as talking about being selected from within the people. And he emphasizes that they have to be chosen to act l'shem shamayim, that they have to act with pure motives in the service of the people, which raises itself interesting questions. So what do we mean by that, and what indeed do we require? Chazon Ish wrote in his Sefer in Bava Basra that if these people who are appointed to run the community, they don't act l'shem shamayim, but they act for their own sake, they act to serve their own interests, so the Chazon Ish says their rulings are null and void. They don't have any impact. And his thinking seems to be that the whole basis of their authority is that they are acting as the voice of the people. And we try to make it efficient. You act as the voice of the people by having a representative democracy because we can't have all of the people vote on every question. But if that's not what's happening because they're serving only their own interests, so the Chazon Ish understands that that's nothing. It's no good. Doesn't serve any function. And this really goes back to an earlier debate, the debate in the Rishonim between Rabbeinu Tam in his Sefer HaYashar and the Rav Yoh. Both views are quoted in Shulchan Aruch in the beginning of Choshen Mishpat. Whether this panel, this communal leadership, do they have the right to make a policy, even if that policy is good for some and not for others? Or can they only
administer the community in ways that are equal for everyone. The view of Rabbeinu Tam is that they can work off previous practices, but if they're going to institute anything new, it has to apply to everyone equally. While the Rav Yah thought there was more room for new policies, even if they did benefit some at the expense of others, or some and not others, I should say perhaps more accurately. But the Chazon Ish added, even within that view, that if they're only serving their own interests, but they're not there to help the people as a whole, it's all null and void. So that expresses a view of democracy that the elected leadership is really there to be the voice of the people, is really there to carry out the will of the population, and the only efficient way to do it is to have this representative system, because the individuals can't vote on everything, but that's essentially what's happening. Now the truth is, it's not the only way to understand it, and the Chazon Ish himself quotes another view, quotes the Maharik, that the whole point of majority rule is really functional. It's basically that we don't want there to be constant fighting. We need a path forward. We need a way to make decisions. So if we don't have any kind of a system, we'll always have chaos. And the main function of government is to prevent chaos, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us, right, to keep people from eating each other alive. So if we have majority rule, we have rules. We have a system. And if that's the case, then maybe we're not even interested in whether the motives are pure, maybe what people are doing are legitimate or not legitimate. We have a system, okay? That's the way it is. So this echoes a debate that you see today, and the truth is it's not only relevant to elected officials, it's relevant to voters also. And when you vote as a person of conscience, do you have the right, essentially, to vote any way that serves your own interests? On a moral level, clearly on a legal level, you have a right to vote for whoever you want. But morally, when you go to vote, you come in there with a responsibility that I should act in whatever I believe is the interests of the entire people. Or is there a perspective that, no, that's not your job. Your job is to come in there and say what you want, and whatever is wanted by most people is going to win. That's the democratic system. So there you have an issue which is debated nowadays as well within our own system. And that's essentially what you find echoed here. Is it like the Maharik, we just need a way to move forward? So whatever the majority of people want, that's what's going to prevail. Or is it more like the Chazon Ish favored, that really this is about figuring out the will of the people in its collective nature? And if that's not happening in an honest way, we don't really have a system. So I think this is something that affects the mindset of the elected officials. But it affects us also. When we go into vote, what exactly are we thinking about? What kind of responsibilities do we have? And this is a major part of the question. So I think we're going to have to push off quick because we're going to be a little bit short for time. I apologize. So this relates also to a broader question of what are we doing when we elect someone? And this is a question that has many levels to it. Remember many years ago, Rabbi Mark Dratch wrote an article that was in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society about the question of the ethics of electing a candidate. And the question always comes up, well, what if the candidate supports policies that are problematic within Jewish law? Are you allowed, are you permitted to elect somebody whose policies are going to be contrary to Halacha? So the perspective that he addresses this question with is the issue of lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. We know the Torah has a prohibition. We're not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of the blind. And the Gemara tells us in Avodah Zarah, this actually did make it into the Maror Mekomo sheet, that there is a interpretation of this, that it's not just physical, but that it is spiritual as well. But if someone is inclined towards a negative spiritual direction, you're not supposed to help. You're not supposed to participate in that. So then the question becomes, okay, this candidate is going to enact policies that are problematic from a halachic perspective. What does that do for me? How does that affect me? And that's a tricky question, but on the surface, it's probably not a technical with Ne'iver violation, at least on a Torah level. In order to be a d'oraisa violation of Lifnei'iver, it has to be what we would call trei avra denara. That expression means two sides of the river. It's an expression from the Gemara. I actually think it is in the Maror Mekomo also. And the idea there is that the one who wants to sin needs an item that's on the opposite side of the river. He can't get it without you. There's a river in between him and the item that he needs. So you are the only path to making this happen. When you are the only path, you are a necessary tool. So then that's a Torah violation of Lifnei Iver. So is that ever the case when you go into the voting booth? Is it ever the case that you are the one who's making this policy, not just this individual get elected, you're making this policy happen? It's hard to say that we're ever going to reach that level. Halavai, we should have so much power, right? But it's hard to say that we're ever going to actually reach that kind of a level. So, a Torah violation of Lifnei Iver is hard to find here. Now, the Rishonim do say there's more to it. There are also rabbinical issues, what we call Misayeya Lidei Ovrei Avera, that we are sometimes participating in behavior that is problematic, even if we're not directly causing it. But even that, it's also challenging to find here because the process is so indirect, you're so many steps removed from actually enacting any behavior that is directly problematic, it's hard necessarily to say that that's really going to be an issue from that perspective either. So I don't know if Lifnei Iver is necessarily the issue. There is a different issue, I think, which we also keep in mind, and again, in balance. And that is that we're a part of a larger society, and the Torah has a perspective on that large society. It's one that we read about in yesterday's parsha. So you think we're talking about this because the elections are next week, but this is actually a bridge topic between Bereshis and Noah. We're going to read about the foundings of all of human society, the Shabbos and Parshas Noah. And yesterday in Parshas Bereshis, so we read about the instructions to Adam HaRishon. And among these instructions are seven commandments. You can't find them so clearly, but the Gemara tells you how to find them if you know where to look. The Gemara conveniently in Sanhedrin Daf Nun Ches, Daf Noach, tells you where to look for the Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, that if you know how to read the Parsha, so you can find different commandments, and among them is a Mitzvah of Din. There are six prohibitions, and there is one overarching positive commandment, only one commandment that applies to all of humanity. And that is the mitzvah of din, the mitzvah of justice. And when you think about it from that perspective, the U.S. Constitution is a pretty holy document. And it's, here you have one mitzvah, you have one commandment, one positive mitzvah that applies to all of society, really only one, at least in its largest form, or many details. And here, this mitzvah of din, so this is one of the most effective representations of an attempt towards din. So the question is it or is it not? What does din really mean? So this was a major debate in the Rishonim, that on the one hand, the view of the Rambam was that din means that the society, secular society, civil society, has an obligation to enforce the other six principles. That these six prohibitions affect society, and we can't allow them to run rampant. And therefore, there is a positive mitzvah to set up a system of justice that will enforce the other six. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban is in commentary to Chumash in Parshas Vayishlach, because the Rambam was commenting on the story of Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi imposed a very harsh justice on the city of Shechem after they had kidnapped and attacked Dinah. And the Rambam says they did that in fulfillment of the mitzvah of din. The whole question of what allowed them to do what they did. So the Rambam says in Mishneh Torah, it's because there is this obligation to regulate society. The people of Shechem both perpetrated and enabled a violation of the Noahide code. And therefore, the other mitzvah of din meant that that had to be policed. That had to be enforced. And the Ramban disagrees for a lot of reasons. Among them, that the impression we get from the Torah is that they did the wrong thing. Yaakov was very upset at them. So why is the Rambam saying that it was legitimate? So that's a part of his argument. In addition, the Ramban has a unique view here. The Ramban says that actually the mitzvah of din refers to general civil law, what we call choshen mishpat in halacha, all of the rules and regulations that affect general society. So these, the Ramban says, a big chiddush, the Ramah takes this a little bit further in a tshuva, that these apply to all of humanity, all of the rules of monetary interaction, and that's what the mitzvah of din means. But in any event, we have this debate as to the obligation of justice in the world, and it seems that at least on some level, there is a requirement, a mandate, however we actually put that into practice to try to, we'll say, encourage the observance of the Noahide Code in greater society. There's a fascinating tshuva about this in the tshuvas of Rav Nathan Gestetner. Rav Nathan Gestetner was a great posek who lived in Bnei Brak, who passed away about 10 years ago or so. And he has a discussion. There's a tshuva that was written to a Holocaust survivor, to a woman who had been a Holocaust survivor, and she was receiving reparations from the German government. She was getting payments because of what she went through. And the question was, does her husband have any rights to this money, or is it her money personal? So Rav Gestetner analyzes the question. He says that if this is what we call dmei chavala, if this is money that's paid because somebody has damaged you, has wounded you, as the Torah describes in Parshas Mishpatim, so then the halacha is that money is the woman's property exclusively. It's just hers. So he has to figure out, is this dmei chavala? Does it have a halachic category to it? Or is it something else? So he says, on the one hand, if we look at the Ramban by the mitzvah of din, so the Ramban says all of the monetary rules apply to all of society. So therefore, the halacha of paying for damages in a physical sense, dmei chavala, applies here to the Nazis as well. And therefore, it's a legitimate dmei chavala, and it's hers. But then he goes on to say, well, hold on a second. So maybe that's only true if it's the Nazis who were paying the reparations. They're the ones who committed this harm. But it's not. A couple decades later, it's the German government that comes afterwards that's paying these reparations. They're not the perpetrators, so maybe they're not obligated. Maybe this is just a gift. Maybe this isn't considered to be dmei chavala. So then he goes on to say, no, that's where the Rambam comes in. The Rambam says that din obligates the governing society to take care of all these issues, to preside over all of these problems, and therefore it is again considered to make a vow, and again it's hers, this is her private property. So this whole debate, how we relate to this obligation of din, has implications, and presumably it has at least conceptual ramifications for how we participate in society. So what are we doing? Do we act in our own interests? Do we act to preserve our own interests? Or do we also feel an obligation to influence society in the observance of the Noahide Code, of the other six concepts of the mitzvahs of Bnei Noah? So the truth is, there probably is a role for both. And this is a part of the balance. That on the one hand, we certainly do need to preserve our own interests. That's a basic necessity of life. Chayecha kodmim, as the Talmud says. But at the same time, to whatever extent we can influence the observance of the mitzvot b'nei Noach, that's presumably also something that's on our radar screen. So we're coming with a balance, and again, here is an area which, like everything we're talking about today, reasonable people will disagree and can and should disagree. But these are a part of the factors. How will we try to influence so many issues that are a part of the current debate, whether it's the death penalty, whether it's abortion, whether it's so many other things that address the Shana Mitzvos B'nai Noach. So how will we try to impact that debate, or will we act more narrowly to protect our interests? That's a part of the tension that we feel, and that's one of the issues that comes in as we go into the voting booth. And of course, issues related to Israel are very much a part of our concern for a number of reasons. Here it comes from a perspective of our own interests, absolutely, but we also want to believe that it comes from a broader Bnei Noach perspective as well, because we believe that the values of the State of Israel are representative of the values that are the best of American values, and we hope that to whatever extent we can advance those interests, we're advancing the interests of the American people as well, and also whatever we can do to bring those values in alignment and to bring a recognition of those values, that's also a part of our responsibility. And it's interesting as well, you can even fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, not in the sense of everyone who says if so-and-so wins, I'm moving to Israel, but in the sense of what the Avnei Nezer, the Tzachat Shavar Rebbe, writes in his Tshuvos, that the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael doesn't only mean to live in Israel, but it means literally to settle Israel, to enhance the settlement in any way that you can. So it's not to discourage Aliyah, but you can do that from there, and you can do that in a limited sense from here as well. So whatever we can do towards that purpose, that's a part of our personal responsibility. It's also a part of something that we see in the broader sense. So the truth is, we have here a duality. We have here, on the one hand, a specific focus on certain issues, and we also have broader concerns. These are all a part of what we bring to the table, and there are reasons to look at it from both directions. And on the one hand, for one to say that I can't agree with everything any one candidate says, it's never going to happen, I don't have that kind of control, unless I'm only going to vote for candidates who never have any chance to win because they have half a percent support of the population. So we recognize that politics is the art of the possible, and by its nature, it's a pragmatic exercise. So it is reasonable to say that we're going to make a decision based on the net sum of everything we're talking about, and whatever is going to have the overall positive effect and the least negative effect, that that's what's going to direct our vote. At the same time, it's also true that things can reach a certain point where we recognize that the pasuk says in Mishlei that Lev Melech Be'ad Hashem, that ultimately God is going to decide, first of all, who's going to get elected in the first place, and second of all, what this government is going to do. So ultimately, only to a certain extent within our control, and we're also making a statement with our vote, and sometimes things could reach a certain point where the statement could become more important than whatever we would assume would be the practical impact. So again, are there any absolutes? Is it the statement or is it the practical impact? No, but that's also a part of where reasonable people disagree and a part of the calculation that enters into our equation. And of course, there's also the question of the character of the individual, especially when we talk about a president. The president is a nasi. Nasi means to be nisab, means to be lifted up among the people. So we hope, ideally, that there's an option to vote for someone who's going to be inspiring, who's going to lift us up. Again, no direct comment. Sometimes that's possible, sometimes that's not. That's, again, something, it's something we would like to have a choice to do, and it's something that is a part of the list of factors that is on our minds when we go to make a vote. And on that point, the question of the character of whoever we're voting for, so that is clearly something we'd like to have an option to show our feelings about when that's possible. And that gets us to a topic, I think, in the interest of time, is probably the last topic we could talk about. But the question of Lashon Hara and negative campaigning and the effect that really any political campaign, but certainly a protracted presidential campaign, has on our sensitivities in terms of how we talk. And we know that we have a serious prohibition of Lashon Hara. It's also in yesterday's parsha, we're told that the first Baal Lashon Hara in the world was the snake, right? And as the pasuk we read the week before in Koheles tells us, "My Yusro v'Baal HaLashon," that the Nachash is the one who speaks, and what does he gain? What does he benefit? And it's interesting that the Chazon Ish had an argument with the Chafetz Chaim about this. He would think this is one thing that wouldn't be controversial. Surprise, everything is controversial. So this, you would think this wouldn't be. The Chafetz Chaim, when he lists all of the different prohibitions that are violated when you speak Lashon Hara. So the Chafetz Chaim, we know he has a list of the explicit psukim, and some are more creative. And if you speak Lashon Hara, you violate Lo Seilech Rachel B'Amecha, and if you speak Lashon Hara about your parents in a shul, then you violate Kibbud Aveim and Moreh Beis HaKnesses and Shabbos and a few other things. So some of them are more creative, and some of them are more straightforward. What you would think isn't so controversial is the Chafetz Chaim writes that when you speak Lashon Hara, you violate the Chil Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name. It is a unique kind of Aveira. It's worse than everything else, the Chil Hashem. And the Chazon Ish said, I disagree. Who would think that's controversial, right? You think it's funny because you want a Chil Hashem. No one's going to argue. All of a sudden, this is a machlokis, whether Lashon Hara is a Chil Hashem. So he argued with the logic. And the Chafetz Chaim says, Lashon Hara is a Chil Hashem because there's no motive. That's what the pasuk says in Koheles, "My Yisro l'Baal HaLashon." What does he gain? It's just something that you do to be nasty. It doesn't have any benefit. It's not like eating non-kosher food or stealing money where there's something you get out of it, so that's why you do it. Here, there's no gain. There's no motive, no advantage. It's just something you do to anger God. And the Chazon Ish said, if that's what he thinks, that shows you that the holy author never tasted the taste of Lashon Hara in his life. He never realized that there is what to enjoy, there is a motive. So clearly, the Chafetz Chaim understood that there is a motive, and there's a reason people do it. But perhaps the point here is that it's way outweighed by the negative impact. And here, this is an area where perhaps we see it, that among the motives that we have is the idea that we want to glorify ourselves by knocking somebody else down. We want to show that we're great, and the other is not so great. So in everyday life, there's a motive to do that. There's a motive to increase your own stature at the expense of someone else. But it's never more true than in a political campaign, because it's a zero-sum game. So this is true in the business world, but it's less true in the business world than it is here. Because, okay, this is pointed out in a book called The Authenticity Hoax by Andrew Potter, where he notes when it comes to business, so okay, so if I have a product and you have a product, maybe I'll gain by disparaging your product, maybe I won't, maybe more people will buy mine, maybe they won't, maybe they don't care about either product, maybe they'll buy both. It's not so clear that it helps. But when it comes to a political campaign, there are two candidates, I knock the other one out, I win. So it's a zero-sum game, so the need and the drive to knock the other person down becomes much more compelling. And yet, that doesn't make it fair and it doesn't make it accurate or reasonable. And that's a part of what we deal with. And on the surface, there shouldn't be a prohibition of Lashon Hara when talking about political candidates for a number of reasons. They're public figures who are affecting our lives. And in a democracy, if we're going to vote, if we're going to make a decision who to pick, so we have to know. We have to be able to factor in all these elements and to make a decision. So on the surface, we should say that Lashon Hara isn't really a problem when it comes to political campaigns. But the fact is it is, because first we talk about the big issues when it comes to Lashon Hara, and then we talk about the smaller issues. So big issues, okay, is there room for it? Yes. But the smaller issues, the more direct issues, are we being fair? Are we being reasonable? Are we being accurate when we speak about people? All of that is crucial to whether what we're doing is legitimate or not. And all of that is sort of vulnerable when our political interests are at stake. We know about the consequences of groupthink. It's been very well documented, and of group polarization, that when we hang out and talk with people who we already agree with, our opinions only get more intense, and the internet doesn't help. Right, so we know that our opinions are not always purely objective, and what we're saying is not always a fair representation of what's actually there. And there are consequences, as the Chafetz Chaim understood, that even when there is some type of motive, the consequences can far outweigh what's happening. And this is something that was documented by a neurologist. His name is Dr. Marco Iacoboni, who's a neurologist in UCLA. And in 2004, three elections ago, he did neurological tests on supporters of John Kerry and supporters of George W. Bush. And he found that the brains lit up positively when they talked about their own candidates who they supported. Then, several months later, when the campaign had really had its full toll, so then he did these tests again. And there were no longer positive feelings even among the supporters. The partisan supporters didn't have that same measurable positive reaction to the candidates who they were voting for. And as he noted, the negativity that goes in both directions has an effect even on those you support and creates a disconnect, creates the reality where we're not feeling any kind of an empathy for even the people we like, and consequentially for the people who will be leading us. And that's a big problem for a democracy. That's a big problem for a system where we hope the elected officials will represent us and will be our voice. That gets us to a place where we really don't want to be. So we need to try to keep this in perspective. We need to try to be inspired by the positive aspects of voting. And I have here, I think, in the Mar Makomos, the letter that Moshe Feinstein wrote 32 years ago in 1984, highlighting the wonderful opportunities that we have as citizens of America to participate in this process, and to remember that ultimately it's all about building. And that's also yesterday's parsha. We read about Bereishis, about the creation of the world,
And Rashi famously asks, why do we need that story? Right? Why don't we just start with the mitzvos? Why don't we just skip the parsha's bo? Why do we need the story of creation? And Rav Soloveitchik answered differently than Rashi. We need it because it's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah b'halakta b'drocha. It's a mitzvah to follow in God's path, which the Gemara says is about chesed. Rav Soloveitchik said it's about that and more. And any time we're told about what God does, that's a mitzvah to us. So if the Torah tells us about the creation of the world, that's a commandment to us to be like that, to be constructive, to be builders, to be people who are looking to make something and not to tear down. And it's hard to remember that that's what we're here for. It's hard to remember when you go into the voting booth that ultimately that's what you're hoping for. You're looking to contribute to the wonderful society that sustains us and enables us to flourish. And how can we do that in the most positive way despite everything else that may be pulling us down, that may be taking us away from that perspective? So just to quickly review, and I apologize again for running out afterwards, but essentially we tried to look at some perspectives to what voting is about. We started noting that in the Torah it doesn't seem like we're in a democratic system. It seems like we're looking towards a monarchy. But this was a topic of debate, whether monarchy was a commandment or a permission or a concession, and does it perhaps vary based on different societies. And we do find models of democracy below the monarchy within halacha, and that the truth probably is, like Churchill said, democracy is flawed. Democracy is the worst system except for all of those others that have been tried. So when you have the possibility of a God-appointed king, so certainly that is better than a democracy. But at the same time, when that's not a possibility, protecting the needs of the innocent and of the individuals and of the minorities, that's where democracy comes in, and that's where it does seem to be an ideal. And in fact, the Gemara tells us, as it did, that we don't appoint a parnas on the tzibur unless we consult with the people first. So we talked about the process for choosing the Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir, how they have to be people who are acting L'Shem Shamayim. We saw a debate among Rabbeinu Tam and the Rav Yoh as to whether they can make new enactments that will be advantageous to some and not to others, and how the Chazon Ish said that no matter what, they can't act only in their own interests, and if they do, they're not the voice of the people, and therefore their policies are null and void, while at the same time acknowledging the Maharik, who said the whole point is to prevent machlokas and chaos by having a majority rule policy. Maybe we're not so focused on what the motives are. So we have both of these perspectives, which affect not only what the elected officials do, but affect what we think as voters. What kind of perspective do we bring into the voting booth revolves around that question. And then we talk about the issue of a behavior. Are we potentially enabling behavior that might be contrary to halacha? We noted that it's unlikely that's a real issue, certainly on a Torah level, probably on a level midrabanan as well. But we talked more about the question of mitzvos b'nei Noach, about the idea that there is a mitzvah of din that creates a responsibility to all of society. We talked about the debate between the Rambam and the Ramban and Rav Nosson Gestetner's tshuva about reparations, how that affects things, and that's also a part of the question here. What's our responsibility? When do we act to preserve our own interests, and when do we act more on behalf of society? Again, that's a tension that we come with as well. And we talked about the role of issues affecting Eretz Yisrael, and about the fact that, yes, that's also a personalized interest, but it's also something that we believe is in the interest of the entire world and of the United States, and also is possibly a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And then we talked also about the balance. On the one hand, it's the pragmatic art of the possible, so it's reasonable to say, I will add up and whatever is least bad and most good, that's what I'm going to do. But at the same time, ultimately to recognize that Lev Melech B'yad Hashem, God is going to decide what's going to happen, and therefore, really what's left to us is to act on our conscience and hope that that will have a positive impact. And we also talked about character, how much we wish we have character to highlight and to look up to. The idea of a Nasi, someone who is Nisa, lifted up over the nation. And we talked about how that gets into the whole question of Lashon Hara and speaking about and disparaging others. How the Chavetz Chaim said there's no motive for Lashon Hara. The Chazon Ish said, how could that be? You don't know what you're talking about, literally. And that the point was that the motives of knocking someone else down to make yourself look better is so insignificant compared to the damage. And we talk about a political campaign, it's all about that, a zero-sum game. He loses, I win. It's all about knocking someone else down to lift myself up, but that doesn't mean it's fair, it doesn't mean it's reasonable, it doesn't mean that it's justified.
under any of what we look for in Hilchos Lashon Hara.
And we talked about this neurological study that established that even supporters of a candidate are greatly diminished in their appreciation once the campaign is over.
And that's not something that we can really sustain as a democracy that has a positive issue. And so we hope that when we go into the voting booth, however and whoever we vote for, that we're able to bring this positive message, the message of Parshas Bereishis that tells us to follow God in being a constructive builder, one who looks to enhance the society in which we live and which treats us so well, and that hopefully having that type of an attitude, that type of perspective, can take us through all of the negativity, can take us past all of the mud that's being flung back and forth, and we can be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim in contributing in a positive and elevated way to the society. Hey, thank you so much. Again, I apologize for running out. We should have
recovering from a game, as I'm sure you're aware of the difficulty that
back in
usually not, but this year, like, one day is Christmas and one day is New Year's, so it,